Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. I'm stepping in today for my colleague, Charles Wolforth. We share the steering wheel here at Hometown Alaska as we alternate shows. Charles planned today's topic and invited our guests, but due to an unexpected scheduling conflict, he's unable to take the host seat today. So here I am. Our topic is Understanding Alaska's Recession. How deep will it go? How bad will it be? That depends, as we'll learn today. Here to unpack the latest twists and turns in our state's bumpy budget life are two Alaska economists, Musin Ghatabi, a professor of economics and a researcher at the University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research. Welcome, Musin.
Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you today. And we also have Jonathan King, vice president and senior economist at the independent firm Northern Economics. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Would you like to go by Jonathan or John?
Full name, please.
Okay, Jonathan. So welcome to you both. Each scientist has painted a future picture of our state based on different budget decisions, trimming the PFD, not trimming the PFD, using PFD earnings, cutting the budget, adding taxes, as a way to shine the light further down Alaska's economic path. What will Alaska be like in 2018, in 2026? They project job losses, population decline, and essentially a more modest state with smaller ambitions. Today, we'll take a fuller look at their projections, and they may have even updated them since I read their last report. Before we begin, Musin and Jonathan each prepared presentations for the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee in late January. We've attached those PowerPoints to our Hometown Alaska web promo at alaskapublic.org. So if you want to dig into their numbers after today's discussion, you can. And please join us in this conversation with your questions and observations. You can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And of course, we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, as we were getting ready for the show, I told Musin and Jonathan that while I was reading their reports, which are dated in January, so they're a little out of date, I had this feeling that like I was on a roller coaster creeping up to the apex, but I couldn't see what was on the other side. And there's a big dip coming, but I could, you know, you just don't know how deep or how bad. And I actually got that stomach feeling when you go down too fast. So I hope we're going to learn today a little bit more about what it's like on the other side of that apex, because we know the state is going to take a downturn here. To begin with, we're going to go through a little bit of your reports, but to begin with, let's together paint a picture of what people might expect going forward. And I know many decisions have yet to be made. Will we have taxes? Will we keep the PFD the way it is? All those things. But you factored those things in and still looked ahead. So, you know, can you describe to me what you see coming up? Certainly something I read in your reports was we might see young people leave for opportunity elsewhere, right? We might see fewer services. So let's just talk about that a little bit. Who wants to jump in?
I can. I think you're right. There is considerable uncertainty. I think we both acknowledge that whenever one is attempting to forecast the health of an economy, there are variables that are very difficult to measure and incorporate with a great deal of certainty. However, having said that, the state is experiencing, obviously, a considerable number of job losses that have stemmed from the decline in oil prices. And I think we all understand that. And so there was a significant drop in capital budget spending. And obviously, there was a decline in activity in oil and gas. And so those two factors have resulted in decline in economic activity, which we're currently experiencing. But clearly, given the importance of those two sectors that I've just cited in boosting the rest of the economy, we're currently in the midst of seeing the ripple effects of those initial losses. And that's before the budgetary question that you've raised, right? And so those essentially are simply the consequences of taking all of that money out of the economy from less government spending through the reduction in the capital budget and through slower economic activity in the oil patch. And so what we now obviously are thinking about, and I'll let Jonathan weigh in here, is given this already existing softness in the economy and the desire to close the sizable budget gap, many of the solutions that are available to us in order to close said budget gap have the possibility of exacerbating the short-term pain.
Sort of a death spiral? No, that's too strong.
Yeah, no, but I mean, the question is a question of reconciliation, right? And so a question of reconciliation that we understand that the sizable budget gap needs a solution that's sustainable, and we need to make decisions sooner rather than later in order to ensure that investors, that businesses, that the public at large has a clear vision of where the state is going. With that in mind, we need to be cautious to a certain extent because there is this already existing softening. And I think everybody agrees that we're in the midst of some form of a recession. And if you do something right now, meaning if you enact too large of a tax or if you cut the budget by too much too quickly, there is the potential of lengthening, deepening a recession that we're already in the midst of. And so that's my two-minute
right.
assessment,
right.
essentially, of right. where this is going. And so even in the absence of these impositions of taxes, of these future reductions in government, our forecast shows that we're basically going to be experiencing a 2017 where there is just as much pain as what we've experienced in 2007 and 2016. And, you know, even in 2018, while things potentially start to normalize, again, in the absence of any future
right.
shocks,
right.
We basically revert back to, you know, an economy that's somewhere around the size of the economy that we had in Alaska in 2010.
I read that, I thought, I was here in 2010. That wasn't too bad. But I really don't know.
No, but the point of that comparison is uh-huh. that we had been growing since 2010, right?
Right.
And so not at a very fast pace. But the point is that we basically revert back to a level of employment that's smaller than where we're currently at. And I think both Jonathan and I, when we first presented this to the legislature, referred to this as maybe our great recession, meaning comparing it to the lower 48's experience, because by, you know, mid 2012, 2013, a lot of states were just going back to their pre-2007 employment levels. And so that's where that comes from.
I see. So Jonathan, weigh in here. Paint a picture for us.
Well, I think one of the things that struck me, and Musin as a representative for the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and I as a representative for Northern Economics, you know, when we sat down in front of Senate Labor and Commerce, we also got to see the presentation from the Alaska Department of Labor. And, I think all three organizations are in agreement that, you know, as Musin said, that for 2017, we expect it to be a lot like 2016, where we lost, you know, 2% of the jobs in the state. And that's actually, that alone makes it the strongest recession that Alaska has experienced in some years. You know, if you go back to kind of the start of the Great Recession in 2007, 2008, when oil prices went from, you know, 145 down to, you know, 28 or 40 bucks or whatever it was, we only lost 1% of our jobs. And we came out of that relatively quickly. The lower 48, on the other hand, lost about 6% of its jobs. And then we see that as much more indicative of what this experience is going to be like. We lost 2% of the jobs in the state here in 2016. We're probably going to lose another 2% here in 2017. And that's really what we would expect to be as we at Northern have started to referring to it as the first phase of this recession, which is the shocks caused by the decline in oil prices. And now we have a second phase of the recession, which is the fact that we have a budget that is unsustainable in that it's unsustainable to give everyone what they've become accustomed to in terms of services and provide them with their full PFD and provide them with a tax-free environment. And so what does the second phase of that recession look like? And that depends a lot on the decisions that end up being made in Juneau. Of course, it also depends on oil prices, whether they stabilize at the current level of about $55. Do they dip back down, which makes the situation even worse? Or do they rise a little bit and give us a little bit more of a cushion? But, you know, we're finally at a point where we can't have our cake and eat it too. And we need to start making some trade-offs. And I think that's really the critical question. So our work in looking forward was trying to help the legislators understand, and hopefully, you know, the rest of us as residents of Alaska understand what those trade-offs are in terms of economic activity, income, employment, and then eventually, you know, the distributional effects on society as you get down to a more micro level and we start talking about the difference between urban economies and rural economies.
Right. I was thinking, I flashed on experimental economics and human behavior and why people make the decisions they do based on their emotions, I guess. And I when I think about this on the grand scale of the state's budget, it feels like, how do you get everybody to behave reasonably, I guess, and not cling to either things they've had in the past and they just want to have them, or an unwillingness, you know, just a sense that government's too big and if we just cut it, we're going to, you know, I mean, people are clinging to these emotional or behavioral sorts of, or ideologies, I guess. And yet what we really, the numbers don't lie. I guess that's what I'm thinking. There's concrete here. We can actually look at it. I mean, I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you think the state has to kind of, go ahead, Jonathan, jump in.
Well, you know, one of the things is that we as humans, we don't change unless we have to, right? I mean, I think that's for the vast majority of us, that's a constant. And it certainly the hardest change is when the myths that we've told about ourselves turn out not to be true, you know, and the myths in this case is I can have the government I want, I can have the PFD that I want, and I can not pay taxes. And that's something that we've had two generations of Alaskans grow up with. So, I mean, that's going to take some significant kind of emotional change, you know, for us to work our way through. And I think that that's what you've really seen drive this change process. I think also, you know, as we look through our crystal balls, you know, we know that things will be different than how we modeled them.
Sure.
But at this point, we are very certain that, you know, barring an amazing recovery in oil prices, right? And we always have to say that, barring an amazing recovery in oil prices, that that we are at an inflection and a point of change for the Alaska economy.
Right. I want to ask you these kind of questions, and you can just deflect them if you want, but it is the kind of thing that I think your average Alaskan is thinking. Should I sell my house? Will this be a good place to raise kids? You know, how will the contraction of services affect me? I mean, and can you talk about those? And I just think that's where the public comes to this. They don't think about in economic terms or in budgetary terms or in legislative terms. They think, what's going to... So are you at all able to talk about our housing market here in Anchorage or, you know, our school system? And I don't know.
I don't want to
put you in a bad spot, but
no,
I think that's...
I'll jump in. Maybe I won't answer the question directly, but I'm an economist, so what do you expect? what I'll say is I think I've ended almost every presentation that I've given on the topic with the slide saying that the sky is not falling. And I genuinely believe that because while there are short-term concerns, while the uncertainty is certainly not healthy in terms of investments or people worried about the equity in their home and decisions about whether or not to flee to another state, I think that the size of the permanent fund can become part of the solution. And using earnings from the permanent fund in a sustainable way, coupled with some combination of taxes, budget reductions, we have a way out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose my assessment, while in the short run, there are signs that certainly point to, you know, a few years of pain, I think that it is not a foregone conclusion that the state shrinks considerably and that we lose 100,000 people and that we have 10 years of foreclosures. I think that I really genuinely don't see that, because while there have been comparisons between this recession and the 1980s, and yes, we have lost a lot of jobs, there are a lot of signs that point to considerably more multi-generational families.
Mm-hmm.
The average age of Alaskans is considerably higher. There is more stickiness, which means that mm-hmm. the migration rate that I expect is going to be lower than what we've seen in mm-hmm. the past. Obviously, the quality of services, the diversity of our economy, and one of the things I always point to, while it's hard to measure, is when you look, for example, at the number of multinational chains that exist here, that to me potentially says that their ability to absorb short-term pain is much more pronounced than if we were an economy that just relied on very small stores that would shut down if there were 2 months of negative growth.
So and do you mean like Walmart and Target?
Yeah.
I mean,
REI. All uh-huh. of these stores potentially have much deeper pockets, right? And so, and they're able to plan 10 years ahead, 20 years ahead, and therefore, you know, they're better able to potentially withstand these short-term negative shocks or reductions in spending by households. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, my assessment is, yes, in the next couple of years, we're going to continue losing jobs. I think that the lack of decision-making potentially hurts us more, because people that do have options, i.e. the talented individuals who are nervous about the current climate, are not helped by uncertainty or by a legislature that's not willing to act,
I mean,
right?
And so, it sounds almost like stability would help, even though we know it's painful. Go ahead, John. Jonathan, jump in.
I think that the Musin's just point here about the uncertainty is, you know, this has become a major factor in many of the discussions that we've had and that we've talked when you watch people testifying in front of the legislature. And you know, we hear about the need for certainty a lot from the oil industry. But the fact is that all of us tend to like a certain level of certainty. Those of us that are in private business, when we're making hiring decisions, we have to have a level of certainty.
What if your paycheck, the amount changed every 2 weeks and you never really knew what it was going to be?
Well,
right?
I also think for those of us that are, you know, we're Northern Economics, we're in a knowledge industry, there's a lot of times where we have to recruit from outside of the state to find somebody to bring up here, and it's very expensive. And we want to make sure that before we dislocate that person from where they're living, that we're going to be able to employ them here, right?
It's stable.
Stable. And I think that uncertainty principle, you know, that a lot of the fear that we're seeing now, where, you know, maybe people don't want to put their homes on the market because they're scared of what they might find, or they're really concerned about it. They're concerned in part because we don't understand, and they don't understand what the future holds. You know, am I going to be paying taxes? Is, you know, would there be a real estate tax on, you know, some places do actually have real estate taxes mm-hmm. for when you sell your house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those sorts of things, that uncertainty of not knowing what the future looks like, it raises people's stress level, it closes their wallets, it prevents them from planning, and at times it can push them into making rash decisions mm-hmm. that they wouldn't otherwise make. And so I think one of the things that we'll see is that, you know, if we can get some level of resolution out of the legislature, particularly if we can get it this year and they don't punt again until next year, is that we will start to see an understanding of, you know, okay, we've got a couple years that are going to be rough, and then people can assess their individual situations. And yeah, we'll probably lose some people along with the jobs. But, you know, Musin is right. We have many more multi-generational families. We have a lot more seniors that are staying. When seniors stay, their steady income stays, and that's good for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can kind of have an idea of where we're going, then people can make, you know, rational decisions based upon where they want to live and whether or not Alaska is going to be the type of place where, they want to live. Now, someone for whom having to have that PFD or having to have a tax-free lifestyle, or if they had planned on their, you know, Anchorage hillside home funding their condo in Maui, they may make different decisions based upon what's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So we need to have some level of certainty knowing that we've got a couple hard years ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to let our listeners know, if you tuning in, don't be afraid of this conversation. This is a good conversation to have, right? Maybe we'll arrive at some stability here. But we're talking about the state's economy and the certain downturn that we are going to take, but we're trying to understand it more fully and, you know, see how deep it might go or what might mitigate some of the depths.
Kathleen, yeah. One of the things you just said was that we're going to be in a downturn. Well, we're there.
We've been there for a while.
We've been there for over a year now.
Yeah.
And you know what? The sky's blue today, at least in Anchorage. It's blue.
The sun came up this morning.
Uh-huh. Your kids probably still loved you, you know. And and so we're there, and we're living our way through it right now. And you know, there are changes that are coming in the future, but I think that people should realize that we're there, and yet, you know, the streets are still largely getting plowed and those sorts of things.
The earth didn't open up and swallow us all.
Exactly.
So, you know, the idea is calm down and make plans, I guess, and try to get your state to make its plan in a way.
That'll help.
Yeah. So just so in case you don't know, we have Mohsin Ghitabi here from UAA's, I guess it's UAA's University of Alaska Institute for Economic and Social Research. And we also have Jonathan King from Northern Economics. And we'd love to hear from you if you've got questions or just observations about we're already living through some recession. You know, we have a legislature trying to come to grips with this. So go ahead and call us with your questions or your comments at 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I imagined that we would sort of talk about the highlights of each of your reports, and Jonathan, give you the chance to update, because I will add your most recent report to our website if you think I should when the show's over. So who would like to start, Mohsin or Jonathan?
I can start.
You want to start? Okay. The things I noticed when I read it were thinking about where we lost jobs. That was kind of interesting. The geography of where those jobs were. Go ahead.
The report that you're alluding to was finished in November, and it was my attempt to try and document how we've gotten to where we are, what are the sources of some of those losses, meaning a decomposition of the losses that we had experienced, and be able to talk a little bit about the regional differences across boroughs, and then just explain why the decline in economic activity or the recession will take a little bit of time to work its way out of the economy again, even without the legislature imposing any taxes. And so I stressed the fact that when government cuts spending, meaning as a result of the decline in capital spending, that decline in capital spending doesn't just hurt the government. It also affects local governments. It also affects private sector, and that interconnectedness is something that we miss at times when thinking about the implications of budgetary cuts, for example. Because I think everybody understands that between 2005 and 2014, 90% of state revenues were coming from oil and gas. Everybody understands that when oil prices decline, the oil and gas sector will get hurt. But I think that there is a little bit of a disconnect at times when we think, 90% of state government revenues came from oil and gas. 90% of state revenues come from oil and gas. As a result of that decline, state government is going to get affected. But state government getting affected means contractors in the private sector are also getting affected. It means households who are losing their jobs either in state government or in the private sector are eating out less often, mm-hmm. are buying fewer clothes.
Toys.
And that's affecting the retail sector. That's affecting accommodation and food services, meaning that there is this reverberation of the effects that start in oil and gas and or construction and or natural resources that make their way into the economy. And that multiplier, as we refer to it, is really what we're living through right now. And Jonathan said this, we are in the midst of the recession. 2016's losses were more concentrated in some of these sectors we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Natural resources, professional and business services. And professional and business services, and I think we can all agree, is one of those indicators. Once it starts losing jobs, you know that the consultants are being affected, which means that businesses are starting to tighten their pockets. Mm-hmm. And we saw that happen basically in the middle of 2016. Now, in 2017, those losses are going to start to spread, right? And so, and we've already started seeing it, meaning retail is starting to shed jobs, hospitality is starting to shed jobs.
Service industry.
Yeah, service industry, which means, and that's the other thing that, I mean, I circle back to something we were talking about a little while ago. And the reason why that the report initially is because there was a considerable lag between when oil prices dropped and when we started seeing these job losses, which gave people a false sense of security to a certain extent.
Older budgets that were still playing out into the economy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's something that, again, is not terribly visible, but is really incredibly important, meaning that when money gets allocated and when money hits the street are two very different things. And sometimes it can take as much as 2 years. And so the last month in which we had oil prices above $100 was August of 2014. Mm-hmm. And so it took a while for these losses to start making their way in terms of jobs. And so now, like I said, we've lost jobs in the main sectors. We're starting to lose jobs in some of these support sectors. But one thing that we're going to see is the losses are going to become a lot more visible because they're going to start happening in sectors
with which
we interact on a daily basis.
Right.
Yeah.
That form our town.
Exactly.
I actually want to go ahead and take some calls. We're getting some calls, and I'd love to hear people's questions. I'd like to welcome Denise to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Denise.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So, first of all, I'm a little bit insulted by telling me to calm down. Our legislators have known that this was coming for 10 years, maybe possibly 20 years. And, of course, we had the legislature elections, and nobody wanted to do anything about it. We've got the people on the Hill who haven't paid taxes for 30 years, and they really like it and don't want it. They're the most vociferous about taxes, the ones that can most afford to pay them. And also, I work for the school district, and this is the fifth year we have been cut. Our parking lot is half full. Our cubbies are half empty. It's pretty serious, and the calm down thing kind of doesn't work for me. I also took a class from Cliff Grow and Gunner Knapp, and as a result of taking that class, I sold my house, and I'm glad I did. Thank you.
Denise, thank you for not holding back. I'm glad that you told us how you really feel. Jonathan wants to jump in and deal with some of what you said.
Well, I love the passion that I'm hearing because, frankly, the one thing that we very much need is we need people to be engaged and they need to be contacting their legislators. They need to be telling their legislators, you know, what sort of Alaska they want to live in and frankly, what they're willing to give up in order to maintain services and schools. You know, personally, I have two children in the Anchorage School District, and, you know, high quality schools are important to me. It's going to be necessary for them to be able to compete in a global economy. It's very important for people to have the passion that Denise is having. And I think, if you heard calm down, really what it is that, you know, panic doesn't help. Energetic discussions help. Strong messaging helps. Having an opinion helps. Being engaged and helps. Panic doesn't help. And so you're absolutely right that this has been coming for years. And frankly, the legislature, put away $16, $20 billion for this day. They also then happen to turn around and spend their way through the vast majority of that constitutional budget reserve and state budget reserve. So if you're irritated with that and you didn't think that was the best thing to do, and there's a lot of people out there that think that, then do exactly what you're doing right now, which is make your voice heard and talk to your legislature. And you know, I love that passion and energy is what's going to help the legislature make the decisions.
And Musi, do you want to add anything to that, or is that?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it's fair. I think that you know she has enough information through the class that she mentioned, and she acted in her best in her self interest, and that's exactly what everybody is doing. You know, you mentioned that at the beginning about the behavioral response to this crisis, right? And so, to Jonathan's point, do we tell legislators what services we value? And that valuation of services, I might add, is incredibly difficult, right? And so because there are two generations of people that have never paid for those services, so figuring out this equation is really hard. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the answer is before us, but what I am saying and what I will continue to say is the state does have resources to get this right.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to ensure that it signals as quickly as possible to the public that it's taking their concerns into account. It's taking the business community's concerns into account. And what I've said continually is they can decide in the next 2 months, in the next month, and potentially have the measures they decide on go into effect next year or the year before. Because the moment they decide, then a lot of this uncertainty that we heard from Denise that we were alluding to goes away, because uh-huh. people know if I'm, for example, somebody that sells shoes and I know that it's an income tax that gets implemented, not a sales tax, I can start planning ahead. I can start figuring out how to absorb the consequences of that loss. But yeah, I mean, I get it.
Yeah, that's great. We have another caller, and I'd like to go ahead and take Keith's question. Hi, Keith. Welcome to Hometown Alaska. And what is your question?
My question is, with the economy that we have coming up that we expect and the real estate, my understanding is that the real estate isn't expected to come down as hard as it did in the mid-'80s. And that we would expect it to maybe just soften more slowly because we don't have all that construction related in the housing market that we had in the mid-'80s that really brought it down real hard. But I am concerned that there's a lot of real strong jobs, oil industry jobs, state jobs, jobs that are related to construction that are high paying. And I'm just wondering if there aren't sectors of the real estate market that will be hit harder, and maybe if the guest could maybe just make some comments on what we might expect. Because, you know, I just understand that our value of our homes is based on what people earn. And as that comes down, you know, our value of our homes has to come down, you know, to reflect that in our economy.
Mm-hmm. Good question. So Jonathan has signaled to me that he's ready to leap in. So yeah. Let's go for it.
Yeah, I think Keith has a great handle on this topic. You know, very rational insights into what's likely to happen. You know, we historically have had and continue to have a shortage of affordable housing here in Alaska, and particularly in Anchorage, but also in our rural communities as well, where it's very difficult to build. You know, as we look and think about the real estate market, you're right that, you know, the first sets of jobs that we lost in the oil industry, we lost in construction, we lost in state government, and we started to lose in professional and business services. These are all sectors where you have to have either a specialized education, you know, some sort of specialized skill set, either through extended training or extended education. And you are starting to see some weakness in the upper tiers of, say, the Anchorage and Juneau housing markets, where those prices have to come down. And you know, as someone who kind of watches that market here in town, I would definitely say that that upper end of that market, traditionally 600,000 and above, 700,000 and above, that's going to probably end up giving more than the lower end of the market, the entry level housing, which has been in the 300,000 to 350,000 range for single family homes. That has a little bit more cushion there because the demand is there.
I see. Well,
so it's, you know, it's different markets. And we do expect that to give ground a little bit, you know, over the next couple of years, because Keith's right. It's related to supply, you know, and then it's related to demand. And demand is a function of how much people earn.
Mm-hmm. So that means it might be time to pick up a Petro Palace up on the inside. Is that right? I mean, that's where you're going to see the softening faster than, say, as you said, more affordable, more modest housing.
Yes. You know, I have always... people have asked this frequently. This is the number one question we get asked is, should I sell my house?
Yeah.
And my response is always, well, you know, that's it's a very valuable investment. It's worth what you're paying for it, right? Because you're asking me on the street. And you should go buy the home that's going to work for you and your family in the long run, right? You need a roof over your head. You need it to work for you and your family, and you need to find that house that works for you. And, you know, if you need to move up in size, then probably in the next year or two is going to be a really nice opportunity to move up in size, because there's going to be people who are trying to get out and interest rates are still good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't need to do that and you don't need to stretch your budget, then, you know, work with the house that works for you,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so people should, you know, just kind of behave rationally and think about their long-term plans. Do you intend to be here a long time, and what house works for you, and then find that place.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we actually need to take a little break here, so we'll be right back. But you are listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. So we already.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I hope you've been listening to the first half hour, because we've been covering what's happening in our state's economy and what to expect going forward. I've got two terrific economists here with me today. Musin Ghatabi, he's an economics professor from UAA, and he's a researcher at the Institute for Economic and Social Research. And we also have Jonathan King, who is the vice president and senior economist at Northern Economics. And we've had some great questions from listeners. In fact, we're going to just jump right to another question, and then we'll go back and talk about Musin's and Jonathan's reports and some of the findings. But let's welcome Caroline onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Caroline.
This is Caroline. Hi, how are you doing? Let me wade in the history for about 1 minute, then I'll get to the point. Back in the day when politicians were friends, Senators John Butrovich, Republican out of Fairbanks, and Zig Ziglar, Democrat out of Ketchikan, they were the loudest voices urging people to not vote to eliminate the tax. That had come forward from Dick Randolph. I think he was our first libertarian. Anyway, they were saying that because it took them years to get the tax put in place. They were going up against the previous mega corporations, and that was the fishing industry out of Seattle. So we went ahead. I didn't vote to get rid of it, and got rid of the tax, which, of course, we Alaskans like to think that we take care of ourselves. But that was one way of pushing it over onto the oil wealth, which was coming in.
Carolyn, what's your focus? Your question.
The point, real quickly, Norway has $1 trillion sitting there. They went about the oil development differently than we did in 14 less years. And that's one of the reasons that we're fighting over $54 billion. And we need to look ahead and maybe contract with them, because we're going to get other things in here. The rare earth minerals, I think, are going to be coming in. So what's the possibility of us saying we blew it and we're not going to blow it again?
All right. Let's throw that out to our economists. Who wants to jump in?
No, I think the Norway comparison gets made quite a bit. Norway made a concerted effort after the discovery of oil to ensure that they did not shock their economy too much by injecting too much money from the oil into the lives of their citizens. They maintained the tax structure. They did not change it considerably. And therefore, there was never as significant of a reliance on oil and gas. The other thing that they did was they established an oil company, which has not now become basically an international oil company. And that allowed them two things. It allowed them to actually get information about the cost structure of the other firms that were in the country, but it also allowed them to potentially diversify their revenues going forward, because now they're actually able to invest in a lot of other countries. But the comparison starts to break down to a certain extent, because Norway's desire for taxes, for a more socialistic approach, differs drastically from that of the U.S. or that of Alaska. And like I said, the timing of when the taxes were imposed and when the discovery happened are basically reversed in the two settings. So yeah. it's slightly.
So it sounds like Caroline's thinking we should hire consultants from Norway. And
I know that there's been attempts to try and learn from Norway. I don't know what the conclusions of that have been, but I don't think it's a bad idea.
Well, I think one of the things from Caroline's comments is, I mean, I think it's first of all important to recognize that nations have powers that states don't, right? So Norway may be empowered to do some things that we're not. But I think a really important point that comes up from Caroline's anecdote is that, you know, if we had chosen at that time to continue to tax ourselves, one, we would have maintained a connection between the populace and the cost of the services to a certain level. And that would have allowed us to put more money away in the permanent fund. And much like somebody saving for retirement, we would have had more to live on in retirement. And so we made the opposite decision. We actually chose to actually have a little more personal wealth in the economy, because that's really what it was, is the lack of taxes is a wealth transfer from the state to the people. And we would have had a lot less personal wealth floating around. And that is a societal choice. And so, yes, we would have had more money in the bank, and it would be an easier transition right now. But we also probably would have had a less affluent society. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, you know, we would be better off at this moment if we had chosen a little bit more of the Norway model. But that wasn't, unfortunately, the choice that was made. And, you know, hopefully, if, you know, one of the potential benefits of having some level of tax structure is to reestablish that connection between the cost of services and the cost
of
providing them.
Which is an unknown for two generations here in Alaska.
And just one last point, and again, this is not to say that the decision at the time was right or wrong, but having money float into the economy through spending, you know, as a result of the oil revenues has benefited the state immensely, right? And so it's very, very difficult to imagine a state as big without investment in roads, without actually reducing the cost of investment for many a firm that's come up here, right? Mm-hmm. And so because essentially you were building an island economy from scratch, and a lot of the time the initial investments make it possible for a firm to come in 20, 30 years later and jump in. And we were talking about multinational retailers that come in here because people have resources, because the roads are better, because we have an educated citizenry. And so, you know, it's tough to go back and try to play it out and say, Jonathan is right. Clearly, we would have had more money in the fund, but you know,
yeah.
would we be as big? Would we, you know, have as many services? You know,
it's, yeah. And we might have not grown as many synapses as we did grow that might help us in the next phase, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so and that's something that's really important, is that this hidden diversity allows the state to withstand some of these shocks or some of these slowdowns, because, you know, now we have businesses that have roots in a lot of different communities. To Jonathan's point earlier, we have, while we still have one of the smallest over 65 populations, it's growing at one of the fastest rates. And the money that those people bring in has nothing to do with the health of the economy, which means that it's a great cushion. And that spending is arguably not vulnerable to anything that's going on. And
yeah.
So, you know,
I remember there was a legislator who said last year, you know, retirees, you better leave because we won't have the services that you want. And the backlash from that was huge, which was, wait a minute, this is billions of dollars. I think it was $1 billion or something. You don't want it to leave the state. We'll figure out the other part of it, right? We do have a couple of letters or quick emails, and I'd love to go through them. This one's a little long, and I haven't found a way to, you know, concisely. So just listen to me for a second. Lisa Short is writing us, and she says, the wage earners in Alaska cannot cover the state deficit. Matt Clayman's recent proposal, HB 146, calling for an education tax versus income tax, is smoke and mirrors. Playing on people's emotions to get them to approve the tax is wrong. There are simply not enough people working and earning to cover the deficit. I'm going to go on a little longer. Dual earning families are running out of money as well. I only hear plans about getting into our pockets and not making major cuts. We have been lucky for many, many years to have an abundance of income rolling into our state. Now it's time for our government to work hard like every other state and get on a budget. Stop blowing through the surplus and make cuts just like our family does in times of need. Once the economy recovers, they will never repeal the income tax. You are essentially talking about only taxing working families, because those on state aid and low income aren't going to pay. Maybe we could get rid of handout programs, $1 cell phones, Planned Parenthood, senators' stipends, etc. So clearly, more engagement here, right? What would you say, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very loaded. It's a loaded question.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, let's address the fact that the state has cut, and I mean, you think, you know, just by the numbers, we've gone from over a $7 billion unrestricted general fund to just over a $4 billion unrestricted general fund. The capital projects budget used to be over $1 billion. It was $125 million or thereabouts this last year.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact of the matter is that the state has made substantial cuts, and there are effects that are being seen out there. If you go out to Bristol Bay, there are runs that aren't being harvested because ADF&G doesn't have enough biologists. There was a herring run last year that wasn't harvested because they didn't have the money to do the manpower and put it out there. And that's money out of people's pockets, right? That's money out of Alaska fishermen's pockets. You know, Ms. Short's exactly right in the fact that we can't cover all of this from one source, being a tax source. You know, if you had the average income tax that occurs in the lower 48, it's worth $1.2 to $1.5 billion a year. That's not even close to it's much more than what's being proposed right now in Juneau. If you had a statewide sales tax that was at 5%, it'd be worth about $500 million a year. Even if you had the two of those together, you're looking at something less than $2 billion a year. We currently have a $3 billion shortfall. So you can't get there on taxes alone. It has to be a combination of cuts, which we've had a significant amount of cutting going on. And I think it's inappropriate not to recognize the fact that we have had those cuts. And you need some revenue generation. We haven't done much on the revenue generation side. It's probably going to be some combination going forward of additional cuts, maybe not to the size we've already had, some level of revenue generation from taxes, and some level of revenue generation from the permanent fund earnings reserve.
Mm-hmm.
That is the most likely. It's probably the most likely scenario that we're going to have some combination there thereof, because you can't get there all the way on all cuts, and you can't get there all the way on all taxes. It's just mm-hmm. not possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm glad she wrote all those things out. I think that there are people thinking about those things, and it's good to...
It's a very common... Yeah. It's a very common expression, you know. It's a very common set of thoughts mm-hmm. that you hear expressed.
Yeah. And it is out there now, and people are talking about it. I have one other that I want to throw out here. This comes from Kevin, and he says he agrees with the woman who don't calm down. Remember Lisa, or I forget who it was. He would like to see, he's upset about the lack of support for the movie industry, and I guess that being an attempt to diversify the economy. And he's frustrated. He wrote over 30 state legislators and only 5 answered. I feel they are not interested in developing other industries in Alaska. So frustration with legislators, it's one of those things that's out there.
There have been many attempts. I mean, the question of diversification, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but the question of diversification is really, really hard and has been attempted. And the value of tax credits for certain industries, the results across the country are very mixed as to the extent to which they actually result in long-term growth or not, and mm-hmm. whether or not they actually pay for themselves in the long run. I don't know anything specific about the proposal he's talking about. I think that the frustration is completely understood, and I think that it needs to be channeled towards a communication that's clear to legislators that there needs to be a plan going forward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just simply saying that we need to diversify the economy is not going to get it done, right? And so, because the reality is that we're a more expensive state. Yes, we can potentially invest resources in some industries to bolster their growth, but I've always been somebody that's argued that rather than diversification, you know what we should be doing is we should be minimizing leakage. We have already existing industries that just funnel way too much money out of the state because there is no support structure that's good enough in order to keep a significant portion of the wealth that gets made in the state. And so a lot of businesses buy a lot of their goods and services from the lower 48, and that takes a lot of value out of the state. And so there are ways in which one could potentially plug some of those holes and retain a considerable amount of money rather than invest in new industries with an uncertain outcome. But I mean, that's just one approach.
You want to jump in, Jonathan?
Well, I love Musine's answer, and you know, honestly, I haven't run into anybody that has said, yeah, you know, I feel like the legislature's really listening to me. And I think we saw some different election results this year, and we'll see how that plays out. And I think there is a lot of frustration out there, and there's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, I know that personally as a I am a small business owner. I have a team back at the office that I work with, and I've known many of them for over a decade. And you know, there are days where I do have to remind myself as I wake up that okay, the sun's going to come up today, and and it definitely does not feel like a calm down moment. But right. You know, then I have to remind myself that panic will not solve my business issues. Right? I mean, I have to engage in a way that works. And if one method is not working, then you have to try a different method. And particularly with legislators is, look, they pay attention to people that are in their district. And if you're not in their district and you're not a donor, then they have a limited incentive structure to pay attention to you. And so if it's not working with letter writing, then I suggest calls. I suggest going to the LEO if you happen to be near a legislative information office, particularly when the legislators are there, going to some of the listening sessions that they hold, if and when they do hold those listening sessions, and to really try and become engaged in those many different ways, because you have to be able the message has to come through in all those different vectors to kind of reach people.
Mm-hmm. We've got another email here from Patrick Carnahan. He says, you guys are getting good strokes here on this one. He says, the answer, like the economists say, is a balance of new revenues and budget cuts. The cuts have been made and income tax is appropriate. a tax ensures people have skin in the game and maybe they will pay attention to state government in the future. The attempts by the current legislature to balance the budget simply using the permanent fund earnings is a bad idea simply because there is no incentive to stop until the money runs out. Balance and diversification is key. So again, another perspective from the community. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I'll have to give a nod to Scott Goldsmith, who obviously is a noted economist, and he has this PowerPoint from 3 or 4 years ago where he says, should you cut the budget? Yes. Should you impose taxes? Yes. Should you use earnings? Yes. And I think both Jonathan and I have said it, and Patrick is saying it. The reality is, in my mind, it's inevitable that government services have to become linked again to the size of the population. That way, there is a better understanding of and valuation of the services that are provided by government. I think that government cuts have occurred, and if there are more of them to occur, we need to understand where they're happening, what are we cutting, what are the implications of those cuts. And as far as taxes are concerned, you know, there are You can think about how much money you're going to raise from each of the taxes. We've done that. Northern Economics has done that. The questions that matter in my mind right now are, in terms of taxes, what are the distributional effects, meaning who's potentially getting hurt by these taxes? What are those implications? And then there are the regional effects of some of these taxes. We were talking before the show about what are some of the community's abilities to raise money in the event that the state were to impose a sales tax. We know that from our previous report that about one-third of local government revenues are coming from the state. State budgets have been cut, which means local government revenue budgets are going to get squeezed going forward. Where are they going to look to, and how are state decisions going to affect the welfare of some of those communities? And so.
Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
I think Musina is having a, you know, putting us on something that we haven't spent a lot of time on, which is this the distributional issues. But I, you know, one of the things that he also raised was a discussion that we should be having as a state is which services are the services that we as a state as a whole most need and desire to fund, because we want our state government to function. We want it to function well, and whatever it is that it does, it should choose to do well. And that's not a discussion that we've had, really. It's not a discussion we've had at the legislative level. The approach that we've taken have been primarily horizontal cuts. And when we say that, we say, we're going to cut your department 5%. You figure out what's most important. Well, most of these organizations, these departmental organizations from the state, they have a mandate to provide a stable level of services across many different programs. And so they try their best to continue to have almost all of those programs continue to function, which means that they all function less well eventually when you stop cutting fat and get down to muscle and bone. What might be a different approach and possibly a better approach would be to say this program is eliminated, and thus allowing a more important program
to
thrive. But that requires a much different and more difficult level of conversation, because every program has a constituency. And legislators don't like getting yelled at any more than anybody else in the world does. And so it's much easier to say, make horizontal cuts than to make vertical cuts. And that's why it's so critical that when you call and talk to your legislature that you say, I support this program, and I support this approach.
So we had so much more that we wanted to talk about, but we actually are out of time, as you can hear from the music. But you guys were really fantastic. Thank you so much to Musin Ghatabi from the Alaska Institute for University of Alaska Institute for Social and Economic Research, and Jonathan King from Northern Economics. And of course, thanks to our listeners and callers with really good questions today. We appreciate it. Charles will be back as your Hometown Alaska host next Wednesday when he and guests explore the budget cuts to public education that are on Alaska's horizon. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Eric Bork is our audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. We'll be right back.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.